Welcome to Occult Experiments in the Home, Magic, Spirituality and the Paranormal, in Personal Experience and in Practice. Sometimes I receive commissions, requests for magical interventions on someone else's behalf. And if these seem well-intentioned, and it looks as if some kind of magical work might be of benefit to somebody, then sometimes with a couple of very close magical colleagues, we'll generally have a think together and maybe do a bit more investigation in order to formulate some kind of ritual that we might do to try and be of help. What I'm going to do in this episode is present a bit of actual magical work arising from a request for an intervention that we received. At the time, my colleague Paul and I were just starting to think about what sort of working we might offer. I received a very welcome communication from Jason Mendel, who very kindly offered to provide an Estes session if I were interested in exploring that with him. And of course, I certainly was. The Estes method, as it's known, is a method for communicating with discarnate entities. It was invented by a couple of members of the team that created the documentary series Helia. And the group as a whole in Helia stage a number of Estes sessions, which generally prove quite pivotal in how things develop. But just because a marvellous resource falls right into your lap, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best one for the job. We had to do some thinking on if or how we were going to proceed. I'm going to say very little about the client requesting the working and the circumstances surrounding it, but the basic details are this. There was conflict and dispute between the client and another person, and the client had noticed that the rancor between them was so intense that they had begun to experience it as if it were an entity, something almost palpable, objective. And it was this that they had requested our help in dispelling. So my colleague Paul and I had a think about this. Previously we'd had people approach us because they were having experiences that manifested to them as the presence of ghosts or some kind of demonic or elemental entity. But this case was different because the client wasn't reporting that. They weren't saying that what they were experiencing was anything other than very intense emotional emanations from another human being. This case had a particular ethical dimension to it that our other cases hadn't, which was that two human beings were involved. And if we were to help one of them, would that mean that it might be to the detriment of the other? The condition of our involvement had to be a very high degree of certainty that we weren't causing harm to any person involved. I'm really fortunate to be working magically with Paul, who I regard as a bit of an ethical genius. One of the things I've learnt from him regarding magical work is to put the ethics of the working right up at the front and use that as the seed of your working, a means of designing it and determining the form that it's going to take, rather than seeing the ethical considerations that you bring into play being a constraint or a limitation. Something that has to be taken into account afterwards. Question number one probably has to be, is it less harmful for us not to get involved at all? As an example, and just to say that this doesn't apply to the present case that we were working on, suppose somebody is experiencing some sort of disturbance in their home, and they ask us to perform a ritual to help with that. But then, subsequently, we discover that their partner adheres to some very orthodox form of religion, let's say, that would regard any kind of magic as malevolent. Well, in that situation, our involvement is likely to exacerbate the disturbance, likely to create tension in the relationship between the client and their partner. In this case, it will probably do more good not to get involved at all. As I've spoken about on this podcast previously, the perennial problem is a mismatch between the ethical priorities that guide everyday life and those that predominate in magic. In everyday life, what we're trying to do most of the time, hopefully, is trying not to hurt others, trying not to cause harm. To a large extent, the priorities are the same in magic, but I think we have to admit that there is a slight shift there. Magical work produces insights, awakenings, realizations. To use Alan Chapman's definition of magic, magic is the art of experiencing truth. However, what is most true isn't necessarily the most beneficial. Sometimes, if somebody's not quite ready for the truth, then its premature revelation can actually cause harm. So, the client had requested help with dispelling a persistent sense of malevolence, and that certainly struck us as something that it might be possible to relieve through magical intervention. But at the same time, we were aware that possibly this was emanating from another person, and our concern was that benefit to one party shouldn't be to the detriment of the other. And it also seemed best, like it generally does, I think, when issues are to do with difficult feelings arising from someone's home life, not to get directly involved in that, to avoid exacerbating it in any way. So we weren't proposing to turn up on the client's doorstep wearing robes and swinging incense around and chanting, because who knows what kind of impact that might have had on the situation. So we decided to do a bit of second-order magic from a distance. And by second-order magic, I mean a magical working in order to determine what magical working you should do. I requested a digital photo of the client's hand, just the hand, so they couldn't be identified from that. And this was shared among Jason, Paul and myself as the magical link with the client. This preliminary working to find out what sort of working we should do to help the client, we resolved to use the Estes method with the following statement of intent that we formulated in advance, which said, "It is our will to contact and converse with a helpful and benign entity that is willing and able to assist with the healing of this person whose hand is shown in the image." So I knew the identity of the client and some of the details of the situation. Paul knew the details of the situation, but not the identity of the client. And Jason, as the medium, knew neither, so that whatever results he obtained couldn't at all be swayed by that knowledge. Paul and I also prepared a short list of questions to address to the entity, which we also kept secret from Jason. In the recording you're about to hear, Jason is following the Estes method protocols to the letter, so he's the channeler in what follows. We're doing the session over a video conferencing system, and Jason's wearing a blindfold so he can't see me or Paul on the monitor. And he's also wearing a pair of fairly hefty noise-cancelling headphones, so he cannot hear what Paul and I are asking the entity. What he can hear is the sound of a ghost box. A ghost box is basically a radio receiver that's been modified to scan channels randomly and constantly. What he hears are constantly changing tiny bursts of transmissions from random radio stations. And what he does with this shifting fog of noise is basically to give word to whatever significant verbal sounds he hears, or sometimes mental impressions he might receive. What the SD's method provides when it's working well is like a real-time conversation with an entity. In what follows, you'll hear me asking the questions. Paul is scribing busily with pen and paper, and Jason is relaying to us what he's picking up from the sounds that he hears. The recording is made from Jason's side, and my end, probably due to my hardware, doesn't sound that great, but hopefully it's clear enough to get the gist. There's a bit of a false start after Jason realises that he's not picking up enough sound on the AM waveband and switches to FM. And I've not taken anything out that was heard in the session, apart from shortening some of the silences between the questions and the responses. The session was originally timed to last 20 minutes, and you'll hear Jason's alarm go off at the end. This version, with the silences and pauses taken out, lasts around 13 or 14 minutes. Here it comes.
Okay. Everybody ready?
Yeah. Take care, Jason. Yeah.
See you guys in about 20 minutes. Okay. And I am muting you, and you should still be able to hear me.
Can you hear me, Paul?
I can. You hear me okay?
Yeah. Excellent.
Grand.
Right, Jason, settling in there.
Me, yeah.
So shall we start with our opener?
Yeah, let's do that. I've got a pen handy, so...
Excellent.
We're good to go.
So, if we have an entity present, we ask you, who are you and what is your nature? Thank you for being present with us this evening.
It's me.
Dear. Who are you and what is your nature? So good to hear that you're with us.
Yep, that's what I was afraid of. Almost nothing on AM right now, so we'll try on FM and go again.
Brilliant.
And there we go. Timer is restarted. We got this on FM. Bye.
Boom.
Can we get started?
Thank you. It sounds like you've made the transition from AM to FM successfully. Just to ask you again,
who?
If it's okay. Yes, who are you? And what is your nature?
I am... I am here.
Good.
Happy.
Good.
Hungry.
Hmm.
To hear problems.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Good. And can you say a little bit about what you are, what your nature is?
Embrace it. It is flashback.
Right.
Never going to come back. Listen to this. That's the thing. I repair. Anyway,
yeah, sounds good. Thank you. And
no problem.
That's good, thank you. Wondered if we could ask you, how should we proceed with helping this person?
From a high place.
Right.
It's nothing. I'll show you a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that you're able to help this person for us now?
That's wrong.
Okay.
It's a question of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Slow.
Yeah. Low energy. And where will that slow energy come from? Can you say?
Offerings.
Okay. Yeah.
I just heard it. This is Jason. It sounded like a extended laughter for a moment there.
Mm-hmm.
Giving back.
Yeah. Offerings, giving back to you. Brings to you.
Don't miss it. That's a preference.
Who should we make offerings of slow energy to?
Him or me?
Okay.
30.
And are there any risks involved in us doing this?
147. Rapture in your ears.
There a risk of harm to anybody? 147.
No.
Good. One other question, if I may. How do we know that you are who you say, that you are the way that you describe
medical
yourself?
Professional.
You're called professional. Can you give us a sign? Can you say something that proves that you are who you say you are, and you are the way that you say you are? Is there a message you can give us?
Don't share with me if I was out the window. That's fine. Come on. A place called Offerings.
Mm-hmm.
At the place. You'll figure it out.
Okay. Can you tell us what place the offerings are to be made and in whose name they should be made?
Poeil?
A wheel.
That's it.
Right. Thank you.
You know it.
Would you say that your nature is angelic? Is that how you would describe yourself?
You said it.
Good. And do you have a name?
What for?
Don't suppose you
In
need
the
one.
Place offerings. Do it.
Okay. Thank you.
At least try.
I wondered if you knew anything about the situation that we're helping with, whether there was anything else that we needed to know. What do you say about that situation?
There is comfy or complicated. I didn't get the whole word there. I'm sorry. Right in the middle.
Is there anything we should know?
I heard, this is Jason again. I heard what sounded like wheezing or something like that, like something breathing with difficulty. Do you know why?
No.
On
you
the
t-
table? A venue or on video, a warning.
What's the warning?
1,000 lives, and then stop. It's me, sir, just one of them.
Thank you. I wondered if you were Metatron or Sandalphon.
I heard, this is Jason, I heard sort of just a scream.
Does that question make any sense to you? Are you Metatron or Sandalphon?
Earth?
Sandalphon.
It came back.
I'm aware that time is passing. I wondered if you had any messages from me or Paul or Jason.
No.
Okay.
Anything you want right now?
Just your blessings. If that's possible.
I want you to time right. This is important. Stay up.
Okay. Any other messages for any of us?
Look for the new any more something.
Is there anything that we can do for you? We can do for you in this moment?
The form of it, the great empire in the sky. Just comfort That's the thing.
Wish you well, and thank you for your help this evening.
Thank you.
It's not an accident.
Right.
Breathe. There's no more to it. Oh.
As you can read on Jason's blog, he's been refining his skills with the Estes method for quite a while now, and I think it's evident in that how proficient he's become. In that session, he can't see or hear anything at all apart from the noise from the ghost box. And I think it is quite uncanny how this method, with someone who's proficient at it, it can really generate the experience of having a conversation in real time with an entity. So, what are we to make of the results that we obtained? One of the criticisms often levelled at this type of working is that it's just random noise, coincidence. That if there were really an entity present, then you'd get a straight answer. The entity would just say what it means. But that's very rarely what you get with this kind of work, and maybe it's worth thinking about that for a moment. Language and words are incredibly good for talking about things in the world and things that fall within experience. But maybe language is not so good for things that fall outside of the world and outside of experience. And that obviously would include discarnate entities. We haven't got anything else apart from language if we want to put communications into a form that can be shared among people. So we have to use language, but I think it's problematic to assume that something from outside the material world is going to be able to communicate clearly and directly using a medium that's chiefly been designed for talking about things that fall within human experience. It took us quite a while to arrive at an interpretation or clarification of what we'd received and that seemed to make sense of what everyone had experienced. And at the time I'm recording this, we're still to perform the next step of the working, the actual ritual to help the client. But I've not felt too worried about this because in the message itself it was said that timing's important, that it's a matter of slow energy, and we were assured that we would work it out eventually. Almost as if whatever was sending the message had seen in advance that it would take us some time. And in that vein, there were a couple more intriguing little synchronicities surrounding the receiving of the message. Jason, at one point, reported that he heard somebody having difficulty breathing, and then towards the very end, we're advised, just breathe. Breathe, there's no more to it, it says. And in the light of that, it was a little striking, perhaps, that one of the participants had been having a little bit of trouble breathing and unfortunately tested positive for COVID the next day. All better now, happily. But one of the factors that prevented us from getting on with the working as speedily as we might have done otherwise. Part of the answer to the question, how do we know if you are what you say you are, is the phrase, if I was out of the window, which didn't really make any sense until we shared a recording of the session with Tommy Kelly of Adventures in Woo Woo and Tommy and Spud Talk About. Tommy was struck by this at once because earlier in the week he'd had a dream and he had been telling that dream to Spud, I think around the time that we were actually doing the working. And in that dream, I'd made an appearance, and I'd ended up exiting the room by going out through the window. Don't share with me if I was out the window, is what the message says. And it's intriguing to think that the synchronicity about going out through the window wouldn't have come to light if we hadn't shared it, if we hadn't shared the recording with Tommy. We also shared the recording with Alan Chapman, and he came back with some interesting and helpful comments as well. Alan suggested the possibility that there might be a collection of entities and voices being heard in the messages we received. And he also suggested that at least some of these might just be time-wasting parasitic entities that were perhaps up to no good. He also made the really important, really salient observation that angels don't demand offerings. This entity directing us to make offerings, yet appearing to suggest it was angelic, must obviously have been lying, because you don't need to make sacrifices to angels. Angels just do what they do. They just execute the work of the divine. That sent us all back to listen again to the recording, to try and work out what was going on. And I think you do see me going down a bit of a dead end with regard to angels. There's a point where, apparently apropos of nothing, I ask the entity whether it's Metatron or Sandalphon. The reason I asked that question was because of the way the entity introduced itself at the very beginning of the session. Never going to come back, it says. That's the thing I repair. Those two archangels, Metatron and Sandalphon, they're the only ones of the Kabbalistic archangels, at least, whose names don't end with the suffix El, which means of God. And the reason for that, according to legend, is that Sandalphon and Metatron weren't always angels. They used to be human. Legend has it that Metatron was once the prophet Enoch, and Sandalphon was once the prophet Elijah. These were two human beings that never actually died. They were taken by God up into the heavens. And it was that phrase, never coming back, that made me wonder if this entity, if it were an angel, whether it might be one of the two that once lived on Earth. In answer to the question, are you Metatron or Sandalphon? The answer given is Earth. It came back. And because Sandalphon is the angel associated with the Earth, you hear me assume that the entity is saying that it's Sandalphon. But that's not necessarily what it's saying at all. I've assumed it's an angel. That reference to Earth could be it trying to communicate that it's a creature of Earth. It came back, it says. Striking that this idea of returning again comes up at this point. Earlier it said, never going to come back, as if there were an intention never to return. But now, it came back, as if despite an earlier intention not to come back, something ended up returning nonetheless. Let's remind ourselves of the original statement of intent. It is our will to contact and converse with a helpful and benign entity that is willing and able to assist with the healing of this person. Well, I think that statement of intent rules out by definition time-wasted and malevolent entities. But we have to take into account the thing that struck us at the very beginning when we received this commission, which was that in the client's situation there seemed to be a problematic entity involved. What seemed to be malevolent intentions from another person but being experienced as if they might be something other than human. What if, in setting out to contact and converse with an entity that's helpful, benign, and willing and able to assist, we had ended up actually receiving a message from whatever it was that we were being asked to dispel? Certainly that would be the entity in the ideal position to be able to assist. But we might have assumed that it wouldn't be helpful and benign. We know for sure that's certainly not how the client is experiencing it. They felt unsettled and disturbed by it, and they want it gone. But if the entity is merely some sort of vague agglomeration of human emotion, can we say with certainty that it's not helpful and benign? That's not our call to make, perhaps, in this situation. We're there to help the client, not to judge the entity. This, to me, seems the only reading that enables us to make some sense out of the whole thing. Can you help this person for us? I ask it at one point. That's wrong, it says, as indeed it would be. It certainly can't help the client itself, it's the problem. Yet, it's a question of slow energy, it says. Where from? I ask. Where are we going to get this slow energy from? Offerings, it says, and laughs. Giving back, it adds. Offerings to you? I ask it. That's a preference, it says. I'm sure it would like some offerings. It sounds like the sort of thing that would enjoy that. But it's not demanding them. Who should we make offerings to? I ask it. Him or me? It answers. 30147. Can you tell us what offerings should be made and in what place? I ask. And then the answer comes back. Poyel. Now, I'd not heard of Poyel before, and in the session you hear me mishear that word and think that Jason has said the word wheel. This is one of the drawbacks of the Estes method, perhaps. It provides an experience of having a conversation in real time, and some of the problems with that form of communication come with it. It's possible to mishear things, and it's possible for people to end up talking over each other as well. But luckily, Jason's recording is very clear, and it certainly is the name Poyel that he says at this point. Poyel is an archangel, often described as the archangel of good fortune and support. And his name is generally spelt P-O-I-E-L, which, surprise, surprise, in English gematria enumerates to 30, and in Hebrew gematria, unfortunately, doesn't quite come out as 147, but does enumerate to 144. What the entity seems to be communicating is, well, you can make offerings to me if you like, but the place where the offerings should be made is the Archangel Poyel. For some reason, the entity seems to be referring to Poyel as a place. When we ask at the beginning, how should we help this person, the answer comes back, from a high place. Now that we've arrived at a better sense of the entity that we've been communicating with, and also, in the process, because they're one and the same, the nature of the entity that's troubling the client, I think it's clearer how we should proceed with that second working. We won't be making any offerings to the entity itself, because that would be inappropriate. And we won't be making any offerings to Poyel either, because he's an archangel. But we will be evoking Poyel, as the entity seems to be directing us to do, and requesting Poyel the Archangel of Fortune and Support to send the appropriate healing energy to the client. So, some thoughts on what the Estes method offers magicians. As was mentioned, the Estes method was devised by members of the team that brought us Helia. So the roots of the technique lie in the field of paranormal investigation. A lot of what passes for paranormal research when done by teams of enthusiasts, like the sort of thing that you see on paranormal TV shows, which I think started in the UK with the series Most Haunted. It's quite obvious that that stuff isn't really science, but what it actually amounts to is a form of magical ritual. Teams of people going into spooky places at night and using mediums or Ouija boards or electromagnetic field detectors just as a form of divination, just as a means to create for themselves an experience of having communication with a spirit. I think what makes the documentary series Helia so interesting is that we see a group of pseudo-scientific paranormal investigators having experiences that wake them up to the fact that they're actually magicians. And the further they go, the more they draw towards recognizing that they're practicing magic and beginning to practice that consciously. The Estes method as a technique retains some of the hallmarks of this. So it's a technique that leans heavily on technology. You've got a ghost box, you've got noise-cancelling headphones, recording equipment, and I think that's a legacy of the fact that paranormal enthusiasts often mistake the fact that they're using technology for the idea that therefore they're doing some sort of science. But underneath all that, what is the person using the technique actually doing? Well, they're changing their sensory perception. They're putting on a blindfold. They're drowning out sounds from the outside world and replacing them with randomized sounds from the ghost box. Jason has some articles about the Estes method and its use in magic on his blog. And he's very clear there that the method is a means of channeling spirits. And in my conversations with him, he was also very clear about the fact that undergoing the kind of sensory shift that the method induces in the person using it creates a kind of trance state, and that he uses that trance state in order to receive the communications. The Estes method, on the surface, because of its use of technology, offers an apparent veneer of scientific objectivity. But what it really amounts to underneath all that is just a more contemporary expression of the age-old technique of trance mediumship. Someone's making the intention to receive a communication from spirits. Someone is putting themselves into a light trance state, and then they're conveying verbally the messages that they hear. As far as we know, shamans have been doing this kind of stuff since the dawn of humanity itself. In my view, the Estes method is simply a form of trance mediumship with a few technological trappings added. And the function of those trappings, on the one hand, could be seen as an attempt to make the method seem scientific, or maybe a way of enabling the operator to become a more effective channel by sort of fooling them into thinking that they're not actually doing channeling, that they're actually just merely conveying objectively something that they're hearing. The scary thing, the challenging thing about channeling, perhaps, is just how subjective it is. To channel something, basically, all you do is let go and hand over as much of yourself as it takes to give expression to something that can be experienced as other than yourself. It requires absolutely nothing other than a human body-mind that we're willing to loan out to something else for a while. The less subjective and the greater the impression of objectivity we can inject into this process, perhaps, the more reassuring and the easier it makes that process seem. I'm thinking here about the difference between going to a seance with a trance medium and using the Ouija board. Of course, both of these are fringe tastes and not really mainstream activities, but I think more people would feel more comfortable about using a Ouija board to communicate with a discarnate entity than letting themselves go into a trance and conveying that entity directly through their own mind and body. And indeed, the Ouija board has at times been marketed as a kind of game, something anybody can do. If you want to talk to spirits or the dead, all you need is a Ouija board, and it's within everyone's ability to be able to use it. And I think the Estes method is perhaps a contemporary sibling of the Ouija board. That's the method of channeling or divination that the Estes method is closest to of all, I would suggest. They're both a set of props for enabling forms of mediumship, with the props supplying a kind of veneer of objectivity, a means of fooling ourselves that what we're doing isn't purely subjective. The Ouija board shifts the whole channeling experience away from the spoken word and into the written word. The most salient feature of Ouija board communication, maybe, is that you end up with a written record of whatever message you receive. Because the communication takes the form of writing, you don't get that confusion that sometimes you can get with the Estes method, where what the operator conveys might sometimes be something that they feel they didn't hear correctly. And also, of course, with the Estes method, all the subtleties of verbal communication come into play. Verbal intonation can really change the meaning of a message. And sometimes if there are a number of people listening, they might each come away with a different sense of what that message conveyed. More so than a written message, I think. But I think my personal preference would be for the Estes method, because it retains that sense of dialogue, that immediacy and directness, the feeling of having a conversation with something in real time, that of course are characteristics of full-blown trance mediumship. You do get added problems of the channeler and the questioner perhaps talking over each other at times, or sometimes very long pauses between questions and answers. But it does seem that the more skilled the channeler is, the less often that these tend to happen. And I think it's worth it as well, because by keeping the communication in that verbal, that conversational domain, that produces a heightened sense of presence of the entity. And of course, a sense of presence is exactly what you're trying to obtain in these kinds of workings. The ultimate skeptical criticism of spirit communication, of course, is the argument that it's all just random noise on which the human mind projects an illusory experience of meaning. The classic argument that we're just creating meaning where actually there's none to be found. My response to that old chestnut is to point out that there is no outside to meaning. If there is a meaningless universe, then it's not this one. It's not the one that human beings live in. Even when we talk about meaninglessness, we're ascribing meaning to it. It has the meaning of being meaningless. As human beings, we're never outside of meaning. We can only ever fantasize about that. It's meaninglessness that's the illusion. To say that meaning only resides in the human mind can't sidestep the fact that the human mind is a part of reality. By all means, we can posit blind, meaningless, evolutionary forces with no intention or design. It's certainly possible to look at it that way. But what can't be denied is that those meaningless forces, processes, have nevertheless given rise to the human mind, in which case they've given rise also to meaning. Meaning belongs to the world. It belongs in reality. It's not separated from it or cut off from it or at odds with it. How could it be? It struck me recently how meaning maybe is a bit like love. What meaning and love have in common, I suspect, is that they truly are wherever we happen to find them. Meaning, like love, we might not always find in places that are appropriate, suitable. It may not always end well for everyone concerned. But a world without love would be just as inhuman as a world without meaning, I think. Personally, I don't think you can have too much of either of them. And I also wonder whether they might not be close aspects of the same thing. Love doesn't always work out, but on that basis, I wouldn't want to recommend to anyone that they should be less loving. And likewise, meaning. Sometimes it can be difficult to ascertain the things that are or should be most meaningful to us. But I wouldn't feel comfortable recommending to anybody that they should put up with living in a less meaningful world. Ascribing meaning to certain things may not always turn out for the best. But meaning itself is a reality, and if we find something meaningful, I'd suggest, that's because that meaning is really there. Thanks again to Jason and Paul for their contributions to this episode. As ever, you can support the podcast and access additional material via Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/OEITH for more details on that. And if you found this episode useful or any of the previous ones, then you can make a one-off donation if Patreon's not your thing. There are some links in the notes about how to do that. Just to let you know, in case you were wondering, the three of us performed a ritual for the final part of the working, including an invocation of the Archangel Poyel. And in terms of results, so far the early signs look promising. Take care, my lovely. Banish often. And hopefully, we'll be back again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.